Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Some may find it hard to believe that East St. Louis was once touted as an all-American city that could and one day would rival cities like St. Louis just across the river, even Pittsburgh, and even Chicago. East St. Louis observed its 150th anniversary 2 years ago. For a while, it looked as if this community, so well-positioned for transportation and commerce, would realize grand expectations. Then it didn't. I'm Don Marsh. Much has been written about why. The latest offering is an East St. Louis anthology, The Origins of a River City. It's part of an East St. Louis sesquicentennial series and was edited by Charles Lumpkins of Pennsylvania State University. Andrew Theising of SIU Edwardsville's Institute for Urban Research is editor of the sesquicentennial series. He's in studio with us. Also, Deborah Moore. She is an East St. Louis native and scholar who specializes in urban politics and has written for the sesquicentennial series. We'll be joined a little bit later by Steve Kerber, the archivist at SIU Edwardsville. He is the curator of the historical materials reproduced in the anthology. Thank you so much, everyone, for being with us. Nice to have you.
It's great to be here.
I hope
Thank
I don't
you,
have to say sesquicentennial too many times. It's one of those words that's difficult to roll off the tongue. Andrew, let me begin with you. Give us kind of an overview of the sesquicentennial project.
Well, when East St. Louis celebrated its 100th anniversary back in 1961, a lot of people had really fond memories of the parades and the competitions, and the men all grew beards and the women wore the dresses. And as the 150th anniversary came around, we decided that something special needed to be done. And one of the things was that we at SIUE decided to do was to publish some of the wonderful materials that are hidden away in archives and special collections, and a lot of people just don't have access to. So we published our first volume in the series, which was a series of essays, and Dr. Moore wrote one of those. And we also now are moving into some of these historical materials that some of this hasn't seen the light of day in probably 50 or 100 years.
Well, that would be testimony, Deborah, to the importance of those documents and finding them, isn't it?
Absolutely. And one important thing, Andrew is a bit modest. Andrew has been a contributor in a substantial way to making these documents available. He took his entire collection nearly of East St. Louis documents and gave them to SIUE, and they are archived there safely and secured for everyone to go back and review and to revisit the East St. Louis that many did not know existed or, in some cases, many remember.
What kinds of documents are we talking about, Andrew?
Well, there's quite a bit in the SIUE archives. But in this book, we reproduced some wonderful old maps from the atlases. There were a few atlases done at the turn of the last century. There were also a lot of county histories that were written. This seemed to be a very popular thing in the Progressive era, about 1880, 1890, 1900. So we have a couple of excerpts about East St. Louis from the St. Clair County histories from that time period. There's also a very important volume that was written on St. Louis history that actually had an appendix on East St. Louis. So we've reproduced the appendix here in this book. And East St. Louis actually had its own history book. It was only about 10 or 15 years old, and somebody was already writing the history of the city. And it's a wonderful old book, and we've reproduced a lot of those pages.
I'll put this question to both of you, starting with Deborah. What did you find from those early documents that really surprised you, that you didn't know before and said, oh, wow, I wish I had known this maybe years back?
Well, just the biographies. It's quite interesting how businesses were listed. I looked at the book and I said, Andrew, this is like a Yellow Pages, mm-hmm. you know, and just how things were listed and the level of detail given to acknowledging the leaders of the time within the community and how East St. Louis presumably was positioned within what we consider a region now, but positioned within St. Clair County, viewing the city as a prominent place that had great potential to move not only the city forward, but the county as well.
There were very high hopes, Andrew, weren't there, in those very earliest days?
There absolutely was. And I think Dr. Lumpkins, who edited the book in some of his writings in the book, makes this point that these people had a vision of the city that they were building. Back in the 19th century, they really did think that this was going to be the new Pittsburgh, that we didn't need a Pittsburgh on the East Coast anymore because we're going to build a new one right here. And that really comes out in these documents. The documents are just gushing with civic pride, which is really neat. And the book of St. Louis history, where it had an East St. Louis appendix, was called St. Louis, the Future Great City of the World. And it was written in 1876. And people really believed that.
I wonder why. Was St. Louis itself larger and certainly, I'm assuming, much more prominent in that day than East St. Louis would have been?
Well, St. Louis's population was skyrocketing in the 19th century. We were the fourth largest city in the country. And the only direction we could see was going up even further. And the World's Fair maybe was sort of the apex rather than just, you know, another step on the trajectory. But the people of that late 19th century, they just thought that this region, east side and west side, were just going to rival the great centers, commercial centers of the world.
You know, I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves here, but I must point out, and Deborah, I'll put this one to you first, that if you look at East St. Louis today and what it is today, one has to marvel as to why it isn't more than it is, primarily because of the infrastructure, the highways that cross right through it or right by it, the river that is right there. It has everything a community would need to thrive.
You're absolutely right, Don. And Andrew and I argue in many of our scholarly writings that the problem in East St. Louis is decision-making. It's not a money problem. It is a decision-making problem. And unfortunately, the city is declining at a rate so rapid that we are losing the opportunity to garner support around good decisions because people aren't there. The middle class is exiting quickly, and there are occurrences of recent times that are moving them out of the community even faster. But if you look at East St. Louis and compare it to a city in Missouri within our region, it would be Webster Groves. Population is similar, budget is similar, but look at the difference between the communities. Andrew, if I may say, was once a resident of Webster Groves.
So was I.
And he sees the similarities from the organizational and structural and financial perspective, but how decisions are made yield a totally different outcome.
Well, Andrew, let's take it back. I want to talk about the present in more detail, but establish what had gone on. How quickly after 1861, by the way, this all happened within 2 weeks before the start of the Civil War, which must have had some impact on whatever was going on at the time. But how quickly did East St. Louis begin to realize some of that potential?
Well, East St. Louis was designed for a very specific purpose, and that was to facilitate industry. And really, East St. Louis was wildly successful from this point of view. The companies that started showing up, really, it was the Eads Bridge that connected St. Louis and its great consumer market and then the markets to the west with all this production in East St. Louis. And so the factories that just started opening up there, they started showing up in the 1870s and they continued through the 1880s. And by 1890, 1900, we had all of these major companies showing up, names that we all know, Alcoa and Armour and a little bit later than that, Standard Oil shows up. These were gigantic companies that were investing not just in East St. Louis but in the communities around East St. Louis.
Again, that takes us back to location, location, location. It had really everything that would be needed for projects like that.
And the railroads like that it was flat. It is a very flat piece of land. It's easy to build, to lay railroad tracks across the floodplain. And so that was just the added draw. Today we look at where highways are and highway exits. In the old days, it was, can you put a rail line? Can you put a rail spur up to my factory? How close are we? And so the flat land, the Eads Bridge, a permanent bridge across the Mississippi, that was gold.
And putting that into context, Deborah, the railroads were just coming into their own. As I recall, it was Abraham Lincoln who really got things going as far as the railroads were concerned.
Absolutely. But if you look at the city today, what you see is the railroads effectively owned the riverfront, which was very profitable for the railroads, but not a benefit for a community that would grow around those rail structures. And even today, we suffer with the ills of rails being in places where we would rather see more viable institutions and services being offered.
That is fascinating. I've never thought of that, but that is the reason why the riverfront has never been developed then.
Absolutely. To a great extent.
Yeah.
East St. Louis, pardon my interruption, St. Louis still has that industrial riverfront. And we would love to be able to put tourist uses all around the riverfront. But the truth of the matter is the railroads use that track, and we're still loading barges across from the Gateway Arch. I mean, that still serves its industrial purpose, and it was all designed for an industrial purpose.
It would seem to me that there has to be a way around that, you'd think, in this day and age.
Well, if you look at the attempts that are being made in this day and age, probably the most notable attempt beyond the Casino Queen, because I won't say that was necessarily an attempt to change the face of the river or even the face of East St. Louis. It was a business decision. But it's Malcolm Martin's Park. If you have not visited that park and walked the observation deck to the top to get a view of St. Louis, which is the greatest view in this region of St. Louis, it happens to be from the east side. But the park is pristine. The geyser is unmatched any place in the country. But it is very difficult because out of that ash rises a phoenix, but all around it is, you know, derelict properties, overgrown areas, contaminated areas. But the commitment made by one individual to try to transform that riverfront is just unmatched.
You know, I often, when we have fireworks in downtown St. Louis, will go to that side of the river to watch because it's ever more spectacular watching the reflection off the buildings here. And I know you guys must have done this too. It would be in downtown St. Louis's interest to have that developed over there with whatever, condos, office, whatever, so that there would be something to see. That really is, if we want to make downtown St. Louis a destination, we have to see something aside from the arch when we get there.
That's right.
That's a very good point. And the idea that that East St. Louis would be developed at St. Louis's expense, I just don't think there's any truth to it.
Yeah. Is this ever going to happen? I mean, this kind of development that we're talking about, finding some way to do that? What do you think, Deborah?
I think it could, but I must default back to decision-making. Mm-hmm. If there is a conscious effort on the part of the leaders to move an agenda forward that presents East St. Louis as a good regional player, a good regional partner,
that's the key,
as well as taking the interest of the community at large, concern for the greater good, then things could occur. But structurally, so much has to change. Organizationally, so much has to change. Unfortunately, the city is losing some of its capacity. Its Black Grant Program, at the request of the Department of Housing and Urban Development, is now in the hands of St. Clair County. And there are accolades at some level being given to the county for the quality of program delivery. So there can be some influence, but ultimately, the citizens elect individuals who make decisions, and those decisions are certainly not in the best interest of the citizens who live within that community.
That is Deborah Moore. She is a scholar, an East St. Louis resident, and also an employee of St. Clair County, by the way. I should mention that. And we're talking about East St. Louis, past, present, and future. And we're basing that discussion on a new book titled An East St. Louis Anthology, The Origins of a River City. As an anthology, it includes documents going all the way back to the early days of 1861 when the city was founded. Dr. Moore is with me in studio, as is Andrew Theising, who is involved with the production of this book. It's Charles Lumpkins of Pennsylvania State University actually edited it, but you are the editor of the Sesquicentennial series of which this is a part. We'll come back to continue our discussion of the past, present, and future of East St. Louis, and we'd like to take your phone calls as well. How can the city make a comeback? Do you have any ideas? We would love to hear from you. Give us a call at 382-8255 and email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air, or you can also reach us through Facebook. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our discussion about East St. Louis. We're talking about its past, present, and future, the past being based on an East St. Louis anthology, The Origins of a River City, which is the latest publication and part of a sesquicentennial series. East St. Louis was founded in 1861, so the actual 150th anniversary is a little bit behind us, but the information is still valid. With me in studio, Andrew Theising of Southern Illinois University Edwardsville, the Institute for Urban Research there. Also with me in studio is Deborah Moore, an East St. Louis native, a scholar, and has written for the Sesquicentennial series. Let me talk a little bit about sourcing, and Andrew, I'll turn to you for this. Where do you find this material? I mean, you've gathered it. Where did you gather it from, and how far widespread was it to find?
Well, I think that it's really unfortunate that East St. Louis does not have a historical society, and maybe it did in its past at one time, but there's no single place. There's no East St. Louis Museum. There's no East St. Louis Historical Society. There's no repository of East St. Louis information. And so it's scattered. It's scattered in personal collections. It's scattered in public officials who retire and the family just holds on to grandpa's books and collections. And that's where it is. I'll be honest. I found most of my collection on eBay. And I could tell when somebody was cleaning out an attic somewhere or a basement. And so that was how I acquired a lot of materials. And those are now at SIUE, and they're in the library and the archives there. And we actually have some wonderful collections within our archives.
Let's talk a little bit about that with Stephen Kerber, whom I mentioned at the top of the program. He is the archivist at SIU Edwardsville. He joins us by phone. Stephen, are you there?
I am, Don.
Tell us a little bit about the challenges you face in curating this material.
Well, let me mention, following up on what Andrew said, that SIUE, under the direction of the founding director of the library, Dr. John Abbott, has always been interested in the history of the region. And Dr. Abbott, back in the 60s, was well aware of what Andrew was talking about, that there was no single sustained repository in East St. Louis. So during the 20 years that he managed the library, he was very interested in opportunities to collect materials relating to East St. Louis. And it was during his tenure that we acquired the collections of former mayors Alvin Fields, James Williams, and William Mason. Mm-hmm. And when the old East St. Louis newspaper, the Journal, then called the Metro East Journal, went out of business in 1979. Dr. Abbott also acquired both the microfilm collection of the paper and the clippings file to the paper. So that's sort of the foundation of the East St. Louis materials that we have here, in addition to many of the books and maps and other individual items that are being included in the sesquicentennial series.
I am not alone having difficulty with that word.
No, you jinxed me earlier.
Sorry about that. I just want to mention to Andrew and Deborah here, as we're chatting with Stephen, chime in if you have something you'd like to say. And Andrew, I'll ask you, as long as Stephen mentioned newspapers, that had to be a tremendous source for you.
There are really some rich collections of newspapers, and we were very, very fortunate, thanks to a man named Sandy Peters, who is a descendant of John Bowman, the founder of the city, who also was the city's first newspaper publisher. And we were able to track down the bound volumes of that early East St. Louis newspaper called the Gazette from the 1860s. And we were able to secure those through Mr. Peters' donation, and those are now part of our archives. And Dr. Kerber has been working on digitizing those pages.
I just wanted to get to that because that is a process in and of itself that is relatively new. Tell us about that and how that works, Stephen.
Well, under our current dean, Dean McBride, the library has begun a program of digitizing primary source materials that are in the public domain. And as Andrew just mentioned, early newspaper holdings are being included in this and many other different types of records. And, of course, the beauty of this is that this will make these primary sources available to anyone with internet access at any time.
Yeah, I think that's key, is the fact that some of these paper materials obviously have not as long a shelf life as the digital material is likely to have.
Well, we feel that this is a way that we can make records and publish materials available broadly and very effectively. And so it's a priority nowadays.
As you've been archiving this material, what have you seen? What has caught your eye with regard to the information that you've come across?
Well, in the two very large newer collections that we have obtained, the first being Andrew Theising's wonderful personal collection, and also the papers of Dr. Eugene Redman, the poet laureate of East St. Louis, there are a myriad of fascinating documents, images, accounts of events, testimony to the spirit and the talent of the people in the community.
You know, Deborah, he mentioned Eugene Redman, and people sometimes forget, I think, the cultural impact that East St. Louis has had over the years on the rest of the country and, in fact, the world.
Well, East St. Louis has produced some stellar individuals, you know, Miles Davis.
Catherine Dunham.
Catherine Dunham. What I was thinking. Catherine Dunham, who made a conscious decision to live in East St. Louis. She made that her home. And it's so unfortunate that her house struggles now some of the properties that she had. Donald McHenry was a
UN ambassador,
and you know, I could go on and from a sports perspective, Kellen Winslow, Jackie Joyner Kersee,
sure.
Dawn Harper,
right.
And so many positive things have occurred out of the city. But if I could go back just for a second, what I had on my mind was what we lost maybe in terms of documents and information with the construction of the new library. There was an old library left relatively unsecured, and documents were lost. Andrew might have a better handle on this than I do, but I can remember the effort on the part of Mr. Redman to try to secure those documents along with others, former State Representative Wyvetta Young and some others, to try to let's get this material. And they wanted help, and there was just not the resource or the desire to use resources in a manner that would have captured and maintained that history that was lost as a result of the construction of a new library building.
You know, I'm thinking of what you've just said here and going through my mind at the same time is what's going on in Mali now, where libraries and archives are being destroyed by the terrorist powers that were occupying that part of the country for a while. I think of the burning of the Alexandria Library and what must have been lost, the ancient archives there. I'll bet that's something, Stephen, you think about from time to time.
Well, we certainly do, and we also think about the threat of funding cuts, which is another modern-day threat to archives and libraries.
Well, it's obvious how important these archives are and the fact that they need to be preserved. Stephen, before we let you go, is there anything you'd like to add about the work you're doing?
I'd just like to acknowledge once again Andrew Theising's tremendous generosity in donating this collection that he has very carefully and meticulously assembled to SIUE so that it might be permanently preserved and shared.
All right, Andrew, would you like to acknowledge that?
Well, thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate your kind words.
Steve, if you'd like to stay with us, feel free to do so. I'm going to continue on with the basic conversation with Deborah and Andrew, but you're welcome to stay and chime in if you've got anything to add. That'll be up to you.
Thank you, Don.
All right. Will you be with us?
Yes.
Okay, great. Wonderful. We talked about the early days. And there is much to discuss, but we have to move along a little bit and bring us a little closer to what's going on there today. 1861 is when it all started. Bring me to the turn of the century and where we were, either Andrew or Deborah. Andrew?
Well, I'll start. By the turn of the last century, we East St. Louis had factories opening up, major employers, and those employers created a lot of jobs. But we need also to remember this was a time of surplus labor. There were a lot of immigrants. And even though there were a lot of jobs, there was a surplus of labor. And so labor was paid very cheap. And over time, that just wasn't sustainable. It really was in the 1930s and 40s when labor unions came in, working conditions improved, wages went up. And that's when we saw disposable income in East St. Louis for the first time. And it was that's when people talk of the golden age of East St. Louis and they have those fond memories of the ice cream shops and shopping on Collinsville Avenue. Those memories are pretty much from the 40s and 50s and into the 60s. That's when the labor unions gave people true living wages. People had disposable income so we could have things like, you know, movie theaters and dime stores. And there was enough money in the community to sustain that.
But, you know, one of the things that leaps to my mind with regard to the early part of the last century was 1917 and the race riots in East St. Louis. Part of the labor movement was responsible for this, Deborah. Isn't that the case?
That's absolutely correct. Dr. Lumpkins actually wrote a book about the race riots. And Andrew, in fact, in his book, spoke to the race riots as well. And the thing that strikes me concerning the riots, and I'll ask Andrew to chime in and be more expansive, is the reporting. The reality is we didn't get a true, accurate reporting of the loss, of the occurrences themselves, how many people were killed, how many people were maimed, how many people were displaced as a result of this. And I think that was more of a polished presentation on what was a dreadful act.
And it was certainly publicized far and wide. I've seen pictures of demonstrations in New York City in conjunction with this. Andrew?
There was a lot of publicity, but really the true facts, I don't think, were really unearthed until the 1960s when Elliot Rudwick at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale did a very substantial study of the riot, and that was really the first major social science analysis of East St. Louis. And he really picked apart those local newspapers. There's a lot of record there, but there wasn't a publicity of the true cost, as Dr. Moore said. There was the death toll was probably around 100, and officially the death toll was 39 African Americans and 9 whites.
And the police played an important part in this and not necessarily a very pretty part.
The police were generally ineffective, and that goes back to the point that Dr. Moore made at the beginning. It's a decision-making problem. People are making choices. Institutions are making choices not to enforce the law.
Deborah, was this any sort of a turning point in the city's history? I know it thrived after this. It recovered from that. But was it a turning point in any sense?
I would say no. I would say there was a recognition of having a community, a non-majority community, you know, a black community that we must respond to and somehow include. But there were the typical processes of separation. You know, blacks lived in certain areas and whites lived in certain areas, and there were ethnic groups that lived in certain areas, so much so that neighborhoods took on the names of who lived there. You know, there is an area that's called Pollock Town, literally. It's referred to that even today. And it is because of the number of people who lived there who were of Polish background. So we found the separations, and as there was infiltration by African Americans to certain streets, I mean, if we think comparatively to St. Louis, you remember Del Mar was a boundary. For East St. Louis, Bond Avenue was a boundary. And then certain blocks of State Street became a boundary. And you would hear individuals say, gosh, you live on 31st Street or you live on 25th Street? So we saw this creeping in. And in the 60s, just a dramatic change in population and a great mass exodus of the white community leaving primarily an African-American community. And again, Dr. Theisen has written considerably about this.
The city was basically a white community, was it not, up until early 1900s?
Well, let's see. I think that the African American population reached about 50% with the 1960 census.
Yeah. And I was thinking of the migration, that the workers that would come up from the South to work in the places that you've already talked about, and that was part of the problem for 1917, was that black workers were taking white jobs.
That was the accusation. Dr. Lumpkins, in his book American Pogrom, does a very nice exploration of what the riot did to the local African-American community. It was about labor on the surface, but the truth is, if we look at where the riots happened, they went into the neighborhoods of the people who lived there. It wasn't the migrant laborers they went after. They went after the people who had lived there for generations. That did not stop migration and growth of the African-American community. It pretty much continually grew all the way up through 1970. We started seeing a decline in African-American population as well as white population after 1970.
I have to take another break. I want to pick up at that point in our chronology here when we come back. We're talking about East St. Louis, past, present, and future. My guest in studio, Andrew Theising of Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. He's with the Institute for Urban Research there. Also with me in studio is Deborah Moore. She is an East St. Louis native and a scholar, and she has written for the Sesquicentennial Series, of which the book, An East St. Louis Anthology, The Origins of a River City, is a part. Also joining us by phone, kind of a silent partner at this point, but we encourage Stephen Kerber, the archivist at SIU Edwardsville, to jump into the conversation whenever he has anything that he would like to add. And we want you to be a part of it, too. 382-8255 is the number. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We're reachable through Twitter and also through Facebook. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation about East St. Louis. With me in studio is Deborah Moore and Andrew Theising. And on the phone is Stephen Kerber, the archivist at SIU in Edwardsville. Because we have to move along here in this chronology, the time, as you have indicated, Andrew, between the riots that we've been talking about and 1960 was relatively prosperous for East St. Louis.
It really was, and those were the fond memories that a lot of people have.
And 1960, as I recall, Look magazine named East St. Louis an All-American or the All-American city.
It was an All-America city for the application was made in 1959 and awarded in 1960.
What did that mean?
Well, to actually look at the application, a copy of which is in the archive that Dr. Kerber has. If you look at that application, it says, hey, we cleaned up the gambling, we cleaned up the prostitution, we cleaned up all the illegal drinking and drugs, and that's why East St. Louis got the award. But it was sort of funny to people who were in the know, because an all-America city really shouldn't have red light districts and you know, illegal gambling districts.
Well, the gambling and the prostitution, Deborah, was that a result of the relative affluence of the post-1917 era?
Not necessarily affluence, but East St. Louis, as Dr. Theising has written so eloquently, was developed to support business. So we were an industrial suburb. So the dirty things, the less attractive things, happened in East St. Louis, certainly not in St. Louis, where there were pristine neighborhoods, there was civic engagement, there was corporate support. But let's have those nuisance and those vice activities occur on the other side of the river. So East St. Louis became the location from which those type of activities can occur. And if we look today, we see oftentimes, the transportation network brings individuals who leave St. Louis because of the hours their nightclubs close to East St. Louis to continue the party.
What happened after 1960?
After 1960, there was clearly a mass exodus. But if I could go back just a minute to the All-America City designation, during that time, the city was already in decline. It had lost its place in the region. It had lost its place truly as an industrial suburb because industry was exiting the city. And there was no niche that the city found to sustain itself. And it continued on a course based on what those elected officials knew how to do. And they knew how to offer marginalized government, marginalized from the perspective of self-interest being accomplished and acquiring the power and using the power in a manner that was not representative of the larger population or what would be beneficial to the larger population. So there was truly a turn, and some would think, boy, it happened overnight. It happened so fast. It really did not. It was already on the decline at the time of that designation.
And I think people may not remember that the armor plant and the aluminum ore plant, the Alcoa plant, they both started cutting back in the 1950s, the late 1950s. Mm-hmm. And so we actually saw this abandonment starting when time in America was really great, the 50s, the I like, you know, everything's good era. We actually started seeing the decline of East St. Louis then.
You have written, and it's probably partially a paraphrase here, East St. Louis was once a place of dreams and hopes, and in some ways still is. What do you mean by that?
I think dream and hope, if we look back at the writings of the 19th century, we see the dreams and hopes of a big unknown. And I think that East St. Louis still is a place of dreams and hopes, but I think it's more reality based. It's we can do better.
Do you see it that way, Deborah?
Well, I see dreams and hopes from the perspective, who will come and allow these hopes and dreams to be fulfilled, because they are not being fulfilled under our current leadership. And I'll say leadership broadly, from the school district to the park district to the, you know, the special taxing districts. In East St. Louis, almost every public entity, every public institution, I should say, is under watch by a higher level, the school district by the state, the housing authority by the Department of Housing and Urban Development. They have a receiver. The city itself, the Financial Advisory Authority. So there is not an ability to manage effectively the institutions that exist to service the community.
I get the impression from what you say that you're saying the people have no voice.
It's interesting. The people have voice, but they exercise it in a very different way. They complain about the lack of services and the lack of opportunity, but at voting time, they vote for individuals who seemingly do not mm-hmm. respond to those expressed interest. And I don't have an answer for that. At one point, we could consider that there were major employers. Those institutions represented major employers. But at this point, the majority of employees of the school district, I would believe, I have not done an analysis, but they don't live in the city anyway. Mm-hmm. So the city has become a place, even city employees, unlike the city of St. Louis, where there is a residency requirement at some level, there is no such requirement. So you have individuals who continue to take from the city just as business did, leaving it with a need to reestablish a middle class and reestablish communities that represent a stable and thriving community.
It's a poor community, and Andrew, the poor are often invisible.
In some ways, the poor are invisible in that they're forgotten. In other ways, poverty is actually very public and out there, and I would argue that we hide wealth better than we hide poverty in our urban areas. And one of the reasons I think that the sesquicentennial series is so important, I think the worst thing that can happen to East St. Louis is if we don't pay attention to it and if we forget about it. That's why I want to see these books out. That's why I'm grateful that we're willing to talk about it on the radio today. I think we need this exposure, and let's not forget that there's a lot of struggle 20 minutes from our front door.
Are these books something that just plain folks would find interesting, or is it more for academia?
These are wonderful books. The entire sesquicentennial series is designed for everyone to use. Scholars can get some use out of it. High school kids could get some use out of it, and just people who remember some of these places. I love that some of the biographies in here are the names. You know, we all have heard of Trendley Avenue, but who was mm-hmm. Captain Trendley? Mm-hmm. That answer is in here.
Yeah, you had mentioned something during the break that you wanted to bring up with Stephen with regard to the graphic part of what we're talking about here.
Well, I was saying during the break that that Dr. Kerber gets a lot of phone calls for images about what East St. Louis used to look like, and that there's this contrast between then and now. And so I don't know, Steve, how many requests you get, but I know that you just got one in email just in the last 24 hours.
We do indeed get requests for digitized copies of images, and we are able to deal with that not only because of the types of materials that were included in the gift of the Thysing Collection, but also because of SIUE's longtime presence in East St. Louis. Don, as you know, SIUE began operation in Alton and East St. Louis in 1957, and because we have the negatives and photographs taken by the university photographers starting at that time of SIUE's presence in East St. Louis, we're also able, on occasion, depending on the request, to provide images that relate to the university's presence in the community, which is today under Dr. Thysing's direction as well.
Just a quick question about accessibility. Can anyone access these archives, or is a special process that one would have to take to access it?
As a state university, our library is open to the general public, but by appointment because of limitations on staff. But absolutely, we are very much a public institution.
Okay. Well, let's bring the listening audience into this conversation in the time we have left. Linda in Edwardsville, you've been very patiently waiting, so go ahead, please. You're on the air.
Well, good morning. In the very early 60s, my dad, Dr. Brubaker, had an office in East St. Louis with SIU Edwardsville, or no, it wasn't SIU Edwardsville at that time. He had an office in East St. Louis at the Broadview. And every time we drove over that way, Dad would say, "There's the Broadview. I had an office there." The place has an illustrious history. I'd like to know more about it, and I don't know what's happening to it today. Dad taught classes. SIU had a thriving branch. I mean, well, SIU was at East St. Louis, and Dad taught classes there. I had a Methodist woman friend who grew up in East St. Louis, and she could not talk enough about her love for the city. A white woman who was born in the late 20s. She couldn't talk enough about how she loved that city.
Well,
thank you, and hello, Dr. Kerber.
And thank you for your call. Go ahead, Deborah.
You know, most women, Linda, and thank you for your comments, most individuals have very fond memories of the city of East St. Louis if they were former residents during the, you know, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. And it's interesting that they cherish those memories. Oftentimes, you will see individuals who were probably former residents driving streets where they probably lived to see what does my house look like now. But specifically to the Broadview Hotel, you are aware that SIU was in that facility for some time. And when they departed to the new campus, they wanted to demolish that building, actually. And the city asked that it not be demolished with a desire to try to transition it to apartments or condos with retail on the lower level. Well, that plan did not come off. And now it's unoccupied with no plan for use or for reuse. And it is almost becoming an eyesore in the community. But it will take a major injection of funds to convert that facility to apartments or condominiums, which would be perfect as a support to the downtown loft district just on Washington Avenue.
Money's always at
money's
the root
always,
of the.
Right.
Yeah. We have.
May I just interject that is a very correct statement that Dr. Bruce Brubaker was under the supervision of Dr. Harold C., one of the senior administrators for the university, and the campuses in East St. Louis and Alton between 1957 and 60 were run out of the hotel in East St. Louis. So that's very true.
Thank you, Stephen Kerber. To our email now, Damian from Belleville says, why doesn't East St. Louis and St. Clair County push for a new stadium for the Rams facing the Arch in downtown? Did anyone say money a moment ago? Do you think? Well, you know, it's a pretty good idea. What do you think?
That really is a neat idea, and I can remember back when H. Milford was working in East St. Louis, and he said, "Let East St. Louis have something. Let East St. Louis have a regional asset. You know, build the new baseball stadium there, or build the new football stadium. Give East St. Louis some regional fixture," and. It would seemingly make sense. I know it's a big investment and it generates a lot of revenue, but we're a big region.
Well, formerly he had been a St. Louis County executive, and his predecessor, Gene McNary, at one time was talking about not only West County, but there was discussion during his time of East St. Louis for that site.
Well, interesting. If I might add, a very interesting thing occurred. It must have been just before the construction of the new baseball stadium. There was talk about let's build the stadium in East St. Louis. And then Governor Thompson came to the campus. I was working on the campus at the time. Actually, I was in the position that Andrew Theising has now with the Institute. And executives from the Cardinals came over to have a discussion about the feasibility of locating a stadium in East St. Louis, and would the state of Illinois be willing to provide support. I think it was all just a part, just a ploy to get St. Louis to say, we'll give you more money, more public money. But it was a very interesting exercise that we all enjoyed in Illinois, having all of the fuss about possibly bringing the stadium to East St. Louis.
I remember when G. Buckminster Fuller was talking about putting a geodesic dome over East St. Louis.
That goes back a ways.
As wild as that sounds, it was a fascinating concept that he had.
Absolutely.
I remember talking to him once about that. I asked him one question in an interview. The interview lasted a half hour, and I never was able to ask another question. It was something else. Here, we have a tweet here saying, East St. Louis needs a Joe Edwards, a motivated guy with money to burn and a vision. He, of course, has done so much for University City. Deborah, is there anybody like that over there that you can see waiting in the wings?
I cannot see anyone like that. I will have to acknowledge, however, but there are two families who were sort of heavy into entertainment, and they had clear commitments to East St. Louis. One family has effectively departed. It was the Galloway family. George and Jesse Galloway made major commitments in you know, venues that were effectively nightclubs. And now the Blackman family, they have made a huge commitment on Collinsville Avenue to establish Blackman's Plaza. So, you know, you have these commitments of individuals who were once residents of the city who believe it can come back. But the focus is on entertainment, because East St. Louis has always had that history of being a place where you could have a good time.
You know, I had heard on many occasions that East St. Louis has one of the highest property tax rates in the state of Illinois. And that really inhibits any kind of development, because anybody who wants to bring in a commercial enterprise will more likely go to the other side of the city border to do that because of the tax.
Well, I've heard that, and I hear that as a general claim. I would love to know specific details. You know, find a developer who will not come in because of the tax rates. The tax rates are higher. But at the same time, if you look at the property tax database, the appraised values are very low. So what's 17% of land that's valued at $900? And how much land is valued at zero? I mean, there is no zero value land in East St. Louis. But on the tax rolls, there are.
Yeah, but if a Wendy's wants to go someplace, maybe Millstatt would be more appealing than East St. Louis if there's a higher tax rate.
I don't think they're relocating for tax reasons.
Right. All right.
I will add, you know, taxes are an issue, but you said it earlier, Don, when you're in a low-income community where the poverty rates are very high, any additional cost of living is detrimental to some families. And what the city is facing now, those residents who own property at least are facing, is an ISO rating, an ISO rating that rates your fire department. And the rating is now very high, which is causing insurance premiums to jump through the roof
right?
For people who live there.
We're going to have
own property.
Going to have to leave it at that. Our time is up. I want to thank you so much, Deborah Moore, for being with us. Very fast hour, wasn't it?
You're looking
at your watch. Andrew Theising, thank you for being with us, too, and telling us about the sesquicentennial series that you're involved in.
You're welcome.
And Stephen Kerber, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Don.
Tomorrow in St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about Rally St. Louis. It's a unique crowdsourcing and crowdfunding project designed as a grassroots movement to improve and better market the community. Among the selected projects we'll discuss are a downtown rooftop farm featuring hyper-local organic food, a new eastern-facing welcome sign to the city along the Mississippi River, and a move to build basketball courts to serve as urban neighborhood hubs. Archive versions of this program are available for download or podcast at STL Public Radio. It's a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.